Live, could make a living from their work without reliance on the commodity model, without reliance on art and as commodity. So we wanted to think of a way people could carry on living and working without thinking of their work as commodity. That's the context for this. What we're going to do.
And try to find a solution as well, which was based upon outcomes and consequences which we thought would be desirable, as opposed to trying to do something to fit the project of the existing mass media conglomerates who have been driving the whole legal and political process, at least on a formal level.
So we're going to set out the thinking that came before that project, like why we thought it was necessary. Then we're going to talk about the structure of the proposal. And then we're going to maybe talk a little bit about some theory connected with it, if you want. If you don't want, we won't, because we've been arguing about it bitterly. But first, to introduce ourselves, I'm Jamie. And I work at a magazine. I do a few things. I work at a magazine called Mute. I'm an editor at Mute, and I have been for the last 8 years or 6 years. This is like a technology journal running out of London, which has basically broadly kind of posed itself against the kind of liberal-wired kind of ideology when studying technology, and tried to bring a sort of more European voice to studying technology critically. And we're kind of involved with various groups like NetTime and that kind of do perform that kind of a function. That's one of the things I do. Another thing is involved with a group called Consume, run by a guy called James Stevens, who used to have a thing called Backspace. I don't know how many of you are familiar with that. But what he's doing now is, what we're doing is trying to start a wireless, we're working on building a wireless network in London, which doesn't focus on distribution of bandwidth, sharing of bandwidth, connectivity to the internet, but instead tries to focus on peer relations in the network. So we say the connectivity to the internet is a secondary issue to us. What we want to do is establish a peer community structure in which all types of media can float over this network. And sure, there's connectivity to the cloud, that's fine. What we want to do is create a rich community network at that level. Those are the kind of groups I'm involved with. As for me personally, I've been interested in IP, in intellectual property, for a few years. I think I became interested in it particularly through ICANN, studying ICANN and looking at digital IP domain names specifically, because I think it was, for a lot of people, it was unclear why we were interested in this stuff for ages. They used to think you were, a terrible geek for being interested in studying the nefarious processes that would go on at ICANN with regards to managing the DNS. But it became clear quite quickly to some people this was a place in which the whole category of property, of intellectual property, is being challenged, because this kind of property seemed to become more and more out of control. And this was interesting to some people. So for that reason, I've been studying that for a few years now, and that kind of also kind of leads into this work we're doing. That'll do for me.
So I'm Alan, and I kind of came at this from a kind of a political point of view. I also did a law degree in the early 90s in Ireland. I grew up in Dublin. And I actually developed a very strong interest in encryption around 94, 95, principally because of the fact that it was a subject which was under discussion within political milieus that I was connected with. And so I decided that I would go up. Nobody was working on this stuff in Ireland at the time, so I started doing research on encryption. There's a lot of some of the bigger encryption companies are actually based in Ireland because of the way in which various international agreements restricting the development of encryption were not really being implemented, or they weren't being enforced in Ireland. I quickly realized when I started my research that the principal application of encryption in the foreseeable future would not, in fact, be for the purposes of personal privacy, but that it would be used instead as a type of steel door to put over, to prevent access to media properties, basically, on the web. So I would say around 1996, I totally changed the whole emphasis of my research. In the last couple of years, I've been working with a group in New York, which is called the Information Law Institute. And what mostly we've been doing is studying, analysing the expansionist wave of intellectual property legislation, specifically in the area of copyright, but also looking at what's been happening in the area of trademarks and patents, and basically in the field as a whole. And a lot of the work that we do is, I say, now this is not an official position, this is at least, I'm just speaking about my own relationship with the Institute. Our interest is developing arguments against this expansionist process. And also trying to think about, well, on a personal level, what I do is try to think about political vehicles which we can socialise, as say, take this out of the area. A lot of people, I mean, less so now, but certainly 3 or 4 years ago, when you said intellectual property, people's eyes closed and they just fell asleep. They just, you know, it seemed that it was a very specialised area. And it's become important for me to find ways of turning this into a subject that is accessible on a mass level. So apart from my work with the Information Law Institute, I also work as, I'm part of an editorial publishing collective based in New York called Autonomy Media, and we produce mostly, I would say, critical, cultural, and political works from a radical left viewpoint, and attempting also to translate works by writers from European traditions, such as our friends down in Italy from the Autonomia movement, and also people from France. Autonomy Media published a lot of things by Foucault historically, and also by Tony Negri. But that doesn't represent specifically our political points of view. We don't actually have one unique point of view. But anyway, so that's just my background. And myself and Jamie have been developing some new projects in the last 6 months, which are now taking up, I would say, a lot of my time. So I'm sorry if that was rambling on.
So that's us. So
should we have to...
We like to use high technology wherever possible. We like the mechanical board.
And by the way, we understand that for most people here, English is not their first language, so please do not be shy to stop us, to ask us to repeat things, to clarify things. It would help us, because it's not helpful for us if we just speak and people are missing the argument and feel alienated. So please do interrupt us if you need to. Do you want to start?
No, I think we should do the context.
Okay. context. How did we get here? How did we get to this situation where we have every year new legislative proposals to expand the duration of copyright laws, to expand the actual area of rights which are covered by copyright? This is a story which in many ways you can put a date on it, at least in terms of the beginning of the formal legal process. And it was 1983. In the early 1980s, in the Caribbean, a lot of hotels there were broadcasting American-made films, and they were not paying any copyright royalties. The Motion Picture Association of America started to lean very heavily on the US government to do something about this, and this resulted in the Caribbean Basin Treaty of 1983, which basically created a link for the first time between trade and respect for intellectual property rights. They gave Caribbean nations access, duty-free access, to some American markets only if they implemented and enforced the copyright law. This paradigm you're going to see repeated throughout the 1980s in a series of bilateral discussions and agreements driven by the United States with all of the developing countries which actually have had an active role in this area. So we're going to be talking about places like Thailand, like India, which has a huge generic pharmaceuticals industry and an increasingly big software sector. We're going to be talking about Brazil, and we're going to be looking at the way in which they were isolated during the, the 11 years between the signing of the Caribbean Basin Treaty and the final agreement of the trade-related aspects of intellectual property rights annex to the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, which obviously led to the World Trade Organization, which is now the main instrument for increasing the level of intellectual property protection worldwide, and it's driven by the standards created and pushed by the United States, and specifically by the entertainment and knowledge businesses of the United States, I'd say also the pharmaceutical sector, and some of the groups involved in telecommunications and also in computer hardware, though we can come back to that later. So, 1983, Caribbean. 1984, you have a change in the US Trade Act to introduce what they called Section 301. And Section 301 basically made it the policy of the US Trade Representative to issue warnings and then gave them the power to actually inflict trade retaliation against countries which did not respect US intellectual property rights. So you have a series of Section 301 actions which are initiated as a result of this. For example, against Brazil in 85, against them again in 1987. In fact, from 1988 to 1990, there are retaliatory duties placed on Brazilian imports into the United States. Similarly, you have an action taken against Korea in 1985. You have actions against, in 1986, you actually have an agreement which is made with the Koreans, whereby one of the things, you know, Korea was a fast developing economy during that period. They were putting a lot of money into training their actual workforce. And one of the things that was happening was that a lot of textbooks particularly were being they were being copied. They were being published by Korean printers, and no payments were being made to the owners of the copyrights in the United States. And so the United States went after him about this, and the Koreans changed the law. And in 1988, they in fact imprisoned imprisoned the owner and founder of one of the bigger textbook publishing companies in Korea called Tower Books. And he was jailed basically as an example. And we see this more and more often in terms of, in order to change the nature of the copyright norms, the actual social norms with regard to copyright, criminal punishments would be introduced and individuals would be taken and prosecuted and used as scapegoats essentially to make an example of them so as to discipline the wider population. During that period in the 1980s, was which, and it still exists now, but this began at the start of the 1980s, was a thing called the Generalized System of Preferences, which ironically was born as a means to assist developing countries in terms of their trade. And the idea was that it would give developing countries access to US markets on a tariff preferential basis. From 1989 onwards, this also was linked to providing access to American copyright owners and intellectual property owners to the markets of those countries. So again, it was the same nexus, was making the ability to have access to markets on respect for US cultural and knowledge-based commodities. In 1989, a new section was introduced called Special 301 Actions. Special 301 Actions, what's significant about them was that it forced the United States Trade Representative to deliver a report to Congress every year about countries internationally that were not respecting U.S. intellectual property rights, and to provide a means for collecting that information and then pursuing those conflicts. And the U.S. Trade Representative didn't actually have the manpower. They didn't have the manpower to be able to collect all this data from all around the world. So what happened was that the private intellectual property trade organizations stepped in and they decided they were going to fulfill that role. So you have the International Intellectual Property Alliance and the Intellectual Property Committee who are preparing the statistics. They're making up the figures about how much money is lost due to the infringement of US patents, how much money is being lost and how many jobs are being lost through the infringement of US copyrights, etc. So this process is used to basically bully countries. I mean, it's a simple matter of political power. It's used to bully countries into changing their intellectual property laws. And for most developing countries, they didn't, you know, what was important for them in terms of trade negotiations was having access to markets in textiles, in agriculture. They didn't really think about what the long-term costs of taking on US-style intellectual property protection would be. And so basically, one after another, they folded. And this finished up, so this process is going on, and at the same time, you have negotiations going on about TRIPS. And essentially what happens is, TRIPS being in terms of the GATT treaty. So, I mean, this is, TRIPS basically what it does is it takes the Berne Convention, which is the international law, the international treaty on patent protection, and it takes the Brussels treaty on copyright protection, and it integrates them into the international trade agreements. So TRIPS, eventually, the only countries to try to put up a fight during the actual TRIPS negotiation process are India and Brazil. And the United States, business organizations in the United States have already prepared the ground during the negotiations. They have made basically the European commissions or the European states, the negotiating position is being determined by the trade interests of the major multinational companies, all of the private networks of business power are being employed to generate national policies on these levels. Decisions are being made, first of all, within those forums, secondly, within what they call the Quad States. The Quad States are the European Union, the United States, Canada, and Japan. They make their decisions, then they go to the negotiating table, and they present that as a fait accompli. And India gets completely isolated. The developing countries do not have the technical expertise, and they do not have the experience in terms of negotiating around intellectual property rights so as to be able to form a common front. And they get isolated and pushed aside one by one. So eventually the TRIPS Act is accepted and it becomes part of the World Trade Organization. The following year, in 1996, in Bern, you have the meeting of the World Intellectual Property Organization, which institutes the World Copyright Treaty, which for the first time introduces the requirement that signatory countries include in their national laws what they call anti-circumvention provisions. This is very much a novelty of the digital period, and it's the idea that digital encryption is going to be used to lock up commodities made available over the networks, and that in order for those properties to be protected, it's not enough just to rely upon technical mechanisms, but it's necessary to create legal mechanisms as well. And the legal mechanisms will be to make the circumvention of these digital rights management technologies illegal and to provide criminal punishments for those who break that law. So this is introduced in 1996. And it's introduced again at the behest of the United States. Bruce Lehman, who was the US Patent and Trademark Office head at that time and who had formerly been a lobbyist for the copyright industry in the 1980s, he's the one who's actually negotiating for the United States at WIPO. And sure enough, when Bruce Lehman ceased to be the head of the USPTO, he went back and he's now working as a copyright lobbyist again. So you can see there's, the relationship in terms of the private industry interests and the government policies is very, very, very clear, even down to the identity of the individuals involved. On top, after WIPO in 1996, another thing happens. In the United States, traditionally, in order to be prosecuted as a criminal for copyright infringement, you had to have a commercial motivation. You had to be a commercial pirate. Basically, have a factory actually producing tens of thousands of CDs or videotapes or, game cartridges or whatever. And in 1997, a new law is introduced, which is called the No Electronic Theft Act. And the No Electronic Theft Act abolishes the requirement for there to be a financial motivation to the copyright infringement in order for a criminal prosecution to take place. And what it says is that basically, if you copy works which are worth more than $2,500, you become subject to a potential 3-year period of imprisonment. Now, when you consider that at any one time, there are 5 million people online using file sharing utilities, most of whose hard disks are filled with MP3s, illegally or unauthorized copies of software, increasingly also of films, then you can get an idea about just how many people potentially come under threat of prosecution, how many people are included in this. I think this is really significant because what we're seeing is a shift from the targeting of commercial competitors to the copyright markets to a focus and a targeting of the individual users. And I think this is truly a historic shift. The following year, you have the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which essentially legislates in the United States for the World Copyright Treaty signed in Geneva in 1996 by WIPO. And that's, yeah. And the in terms of international law, the first time that the anti-circumvention provisions appeared was in 1996 in this treaty, this WIPO treaty. But as an international treaty, it doesn't have any domestic effect until the point where legislation is made, at least not in the United States. I know this is different for some European legal systems, where as soon as you sign an international treaty, it becomes part of the domestic jurisprudence. But that wasn't the case in the United States. And anyway, that treaty, what happens with almost all international treaties is that they must be signed by a certain minimum number of states before they actually become effective in any way. And it's actually very interesting to look at the countries which, not signed, but they actually have to be implemented on a domestic level by a certain number of countries before the actual treaty becomes part of international law. And what I was going to say is that it's very interesting if you look at the countries which were the first to implement legislation domestically about the World Copyright Treaty. A lot of them are small, developing countries which actually have no interest really in the law. That's not in their interest. But what happened was they were bullied, basically, to do it. You need to have 30 states which have implemented local legislation, and the United States government, through the U.S. Trade Representative, was able to bully, you know, small countries, you know what I mean, with undeveloped economies. Graham. No, it's not. The No Electronic Theft Act is a specifically American creation. So it's on top of the World Copyright Treaty. It does, yes. The DMCA does. Yeah, DMCA covers other areas as well. But the principal one in terms of the anti-circumvention provisions is one which is the domestic implementation of the WCT. Okay? So a law doesn't mean anything until it's implemented. Until it's actually enforced. Nobody is going to be intimidated by a law that nobody has ever been prosecuted under. So now we start to get the prosecutions. 1999, a 22-year-old student in the University of Oregon called Jeffrey Gerard Levy, who was running a completely non-commercial site and who was making available MP3s, texts, images, he gets arrested and gets charged under the No Electronic Theft Act. And it's clear, though, that they're really doing this to make an example of him. At the same time, you have the birth of the cybercrime section of the FBI. So they need to have a first example as well. You know what I mean? It's a prestige thing in terms of the birth of a new section of an institution. And so Jeffrey Gerard Levy, you know what I mean, is just, you know, he's just a guy, he's a guy who's got a small web space, and suddenly, like, I mean, he's got a federal charge, criminal charge, felony, potentially 3 years in jail. So of course what he does is he plea bargains, which means to say that he agrees to admit his guilt, and in exchange he won't be sent to jail. That's Noelix, so that's the one collected at the No Electronic Peptide. DMCA, anti-circumvention provisions. Many of you, I'm sure, have heard of what happened last summer in Las Vegas at DEF CON, which is the biggest hacker conference in the United States. Dmitry Sklyarov, a Russian programmer, who was there to do a presentation about Adobe eBook Reader, which allows people to read digital rights protected electronic books. He was there doing a presentation about the security weaknesses of it. Alchemsoft, his company, had produced a piece of software to allow you to unlock the digital encryption. And basically, he was arrested there at the conference by the FBI. He spent nearly 2 months in jail. And that's he was the first person to be charged criminally under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. I think that's enough for the moment. That's just the context of the expansion and the two crucial themes, which are the link between intellectual property and trade, where previously they were considered to be separate things, and the shift in terms of from copyright infringement being regarded as an economic offence only for which there should only be civil litigation, to one which is now treated as being an area for the criminal law and where people should be sent to jail. So I'm going to leave it at that and you can...
Okay, so on the other side of that, and I think this is an obvious conversation that's ongoing for us, is what you might see as a sort of... I've drunk all yours as well. What you might see as a shift in the technological paradigm, which is, I mean, most of these conditions we're all totally familiar with. The rise of, initially, the web, a very good vehicle for kind of demonstrating certain qualities of the internet's infrastructure, providing a distribution, a very effective distribution mechanism for copies files, and the copies being as good as the originals, unlike in previous so-called commercially threatening moments like the rise of VHS, which we were told would destroy the movie industry. Suddenly these copies are as good as the originals, and we have this incredible distribution system, the internet. The web was the first stage in this crisis for digital media owners, and peer-to-peer is the second. And I think you have to see this welter of juridical and this legislation as posed against a technological situation in which these media are moving towards being something like out of control. That this is a conversation that they say is ongoing, but as far as I'm concerned, against this huge welter of legislation, you have, it seems to me, undiminished file trading going on. And as Alan says, if the laws can't be enforced, if they can only be enforced symbolically from time to time, what's the effect of that, and are they really effective? Now, so this is the context. And this, in one of the problems that I think we faced when we came up with this model was that if this is a problem for media owners in the classical sense, if this is, as we already know, file share is a huge problem for media owners, and this is why they're coming up with these lobbyist-inspired laws, then it's also a problem for media producers that we would count as being on our side. People who make music, I make music, and people who write, people who make art of various kinds. We don't feel like, we all know that right now I can dump an MP3 onto any file share system and have it out there, have it listened to. But there's the avenues for me to make money are closing down as rapidly as they're closing down for the media owners. And from our point of view, we'd like the avenues for media owners to accumulate, to be closed down as rapidly as possible, bring it on. But no one wants to see a return. And this is really one of the things we were interested in when we came up with this model that we're going to describe today. The gentrified, the process of the sort of gentleman artist. Only people who can make money, who have money, who can afford to make art, because there's no path to be able to be remunerated for your art or to be able to live through the making of art. And so only people who have the money can make. No one wants to see a return to that. And really, what we started thinking of, well, what are the options for us? You know, what's a realistic system we could come up with that might provide for people to be able to make a living out of their work without, if we assume that the commodity model is so threatened that it's becoming untenable, if we assume this, then maybe we can find a non-commodity model for doing this. So we put our heads together and came up with a model, and I'm going to try and describe it to you today. Okay. What did we want to do with this? We wanted to create what we called a sustainable, self-financing system of cultural production. And in order to do this, we proposed the idea of creating initially a tax system. We wanted to work with the idea of working with the nation state formation. And since then, I think we've moved towards thinking that the money for this pool of cash we wanted to create could be collected in a number of different ways. But the essential idea is to take money from citizens within a state and to put it into a central resource, into an earmarked fund. This is not so radical in itself. In the UK, obviously, we have the BBC licence fee. Everyone pays, taxes are not radical in themselves. Everyone pays 100 quid a year. The money goes into a public fund. It's spent idiotically by the BBC, who then produce rubbish programming. But the structure's there, and people do pay. It's not like complete, we're not totally off the wall at the right from the start. People will pay, they'll pay into these things if they're getting something. So the idea is to get, in some way you get a large amount of people to pay money into the system. And what we then wanted to do was So we wanted to create a way of distributing this cash, and the idea was to use 75% of the money that you've paid into the system to be distributed through a peer structure. And so the idea is that you would use a central database, which could be accessed in a number of ways. You could probably access it through a phone or through the web would be an obvious way of doing it. You could use any front end you like to this database. And what this would allow you to do is say, okay, there's two sides to this. There's a kind of consumer and producer side, but we ultimately will talk about how this system might break down that relationship. Producers would register themselves with the system. So they would say, I have a band. This is my band. This is who's in it. I could be a single person. I could be a group of people. I could be a group of people that designates roles in this way or that way. We give money. I take all the money in my band. I split the money exactly with the rest of the members of the band. You could be a small council of people who say, we know best about under 18 jazz music in Berlin, and we're going to give out money to them. You can constitute yourself in whatever way you like. You make some sort of manifesto or not, or some demonstration of your music, some statement of intent of what you're doing, some place in which your files can be found, and you log it with the database. And when I come along as someone who's already paid my tax into the system, potentially, I can decide to give money to you. I can say, okay, of this money I've paid in, of this $100 I've paid in this year, or this £100 or whatever I've paid into the system, I'm going to give £10 to the breeders and £15 to my friend, and I'm going to give 50 quid to Sonic Youth because I like the last album they did, and fuck everybody else, they can't have any. Everyone's going to make their decisions about this. Now, we argued about the idea of people making too much money out of it, making what happens to people who, like U2, who are going to get, everyone's going to, because of the sort of the legacy issues about markets, people are going to give them lots of money. So we went back and forth about the idea of whether there will be an absolute cap. So at some point the system just says, you can't give any more money to that person. Sorry, they've had enough. I argue strongly that actually it should be up to, why should it be up to us to say, Al pulled out of the air $1.5 million that has been more money than anyone will possibly need ever. More than that you can't have. I say that the system should say, do you realise that Bruce Springsteen has already been given you know, $80 million this year. Do you really want to give it to him? If that's the music you really like, try da-da-da-da-da and give you some suggestions of where you might put it. Because I think I should be able to decide whether he needs $80 million. So this is the idea, is that the fundamental idea is that 75% of the cash that's paid into this fund would go out to the producers directly, by direct attribution from you. You directly say where you're going to put the money. Then the 20% which you've earmarked for infrastructure comes essentially from our strong feeling that it's important to support local area, for example, venues in which people can listen to music for next to nothing, and education structures so that people, for example, can go ahead and borrow an instrument or get tutorials from somebody. So we wanted to just take 20% and stick it into local area venues and places that bands could come and play, so that you would have a structure that you'd already paid for, because we thought this was just a generally good idea. This also serves a useful function for us, because one of the problems, which we may discuss more of the problems later, that we had was realising that people would gain this kind of system quite quickly. They would realise that if, for example, you set yourself up as a musician, say you don't even make any music, well, it's far too onerous for us to pursue you and find out if you do or don't make music. And you might say to all your friends, okay, you pay your tax, you pay it to me, I'll take it. And we'll all pay to each other, and then we can take the money and go off with it. So what we thought was we'd create a threshold, which would say, okay, say it's likely that you might be able to get 12 people that you know to pay you their money, and you can run off with it down the pub. So we say that would be like roughly $1,000 or something like this. So if you come in at around that, you know, just below that threshold, you don't get the money. It's like, sorry, if you get less than $1,000, we'll put it into the local resources with your name on it. So you can go and take $1,000 in kind of resources at a local level. So if you say, so essentially they're calling your bluff, the system is calling your bluff and saying, if you're into music and you're proposing yourself as a creator, you're not quite popular enough yet. You're not quite popular enough to get the support of the people you're talking to. So take yourself down to this local centre. Go and learn something. Go and make some music down there and see what happens next year. So it provides a function like that for us. Now the idea is that the other 5%, I know it seems crazy, but we discussed it a lot, and we wanted 5% of it to be completely random, so that it could just fall on you out of the sky. If you registered yourself as a producer, suddenly a whole bunch of money could just hit you, because we realised we didn't want to over-instrumentalise. I mean, if you get to the point where everything's really instrumental, then the fun goes out of it, and we thought that it would be useful to kind of create random seeds for creativity, because how can you really know, however enlightened the people who are choosing, who they're giving the money to, they may miss something, and randomness is kind of something we wanted to support. So when the producers get the money, they get the money, and they have one, really only one commitment, and that is to make music that's copylefted, that's GPL'd. So as every piece of music you make with money you've taken from the system, with resources you've taken from the public, goes back into the public domain. Of course, anybody can listen to that music. Anyone can do anything they like with that music. Anyone can share that music. Anyone can copy it. Anyone can make a CD out of it and sell it if they can get the money for it. But you don't really care now as the artist, because you've already got paid. And for every copy of your work that's out there, for every time it proliferates, you're being promoted. Next year, as a result of your work having been copied 6 million times, what's going to happen when we come to think about who we're going to give our money to? We remember this music we listened to and liked, and we want more of it, so we're going to give the money. So you're promoted. It only promotes you. So you no longer have to worry about controlling your media, locking it down, working with encryption systems, going to big labels because they're the ones who promise you that they can make a CD that can't be played, and that can't be played, and the machine can't be copied, can't be ripped, and you have to work with these creatures. No longer do you have to worry about this. You're free to share your music with everyone, knowing that next year the money will come back to you. That's roughly the model.
Just want to reiterate, make two points. The really radical thing, actually, about this proposal at the end is that it breaks the connection between consumption of cultural works and payment. So that it is really a system of direct allocation by the user to the producer. And although we've described it in terms of the music industry, it's obvious that this is something which actually applies potentially over a lot of areas.
Got a question.
And it could be, you know, that could be film, that could be software, that could be writing. There's absolutely no reason to limit it. To an extent, we thought about this in the context of the music industry because the music companies have been the ones who've been most active in pursuing their interests through the courts.
And because music's in crisis as well. It was a moment that I think we decided it was necessary to come up with something in terms of music right away because the music industry is in crisis and music producers are in crisis. So it seems like a good example to start with. Go ahead. Sorry. Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
I mean
it's the money. Is it collected in advance and then distributed later? Or is it collected in a B2B process?
We didn't decide that. We haven't decided that yet. Because obviously both have real radical problems with them. On one hand, you've got a trust. If the money's collected in advance, there's a huge trust issue. You need a third party that you can trust to hold that money. And
you mean a voluntary donation system?
If I wanted to give $50 to that band and none to this one.
Mm.
That's what this is.
Sorry? You described it as a tax.
Could be a tax. That's how we initially. Well, obviously, it completely changes if you don't think about it through the tax model. Because if you think about it through the tax model, then you immediately you've already paid to fund the creativity that surrounds us, to fund kind of this social production. If you think about it through a donation, they're completely voluntary donations, then you get something. I think you get something totally different.
Well, what we get here is we get the system in terms of the actual allocation, which is based upon the donation model. Because as I said, there's no relationship between consumption and payment, right? So that means that whoever gets your money is effectively getting it as a donation. But the point is that you have to, I mean, there's a certain amount of money which you have to give towards cultural production. And then it's up to you to make the decision as to where the money goes.
And who's controlling that?
Who's controlling
that?
You get to allocate, yeah, and you could represent that allocation. A system will know how many credits, whatever kind they are, you have to allocate, and as soon as you've allocated them, you don't get any more to allocate. It's quite easy. I mean, that's not a big problem, I think, with that.
I think the difference, though, is that in our case, you make the decision. In the case that you're describing, either a government organisation makes the decision or a private collection agency makes the decision based upon... About who gets the money, yes, about the allocation.
That's
the difference. Yeah, well, I mean, as it is, I mean, in terms of, like, I mean, Jamie mentioned, you know, the television license. I mean, there's $4.5 billion collected every year in Britain under the TV license. But then it's the organisation itself which is making the decision about how that money is spent. I mean, it could be just that individuals in Britain would make the decision about how that money was spent. No more BBC. But you would have, you know, the opportunity to fund something similar if you wanted, or to fund something else if you wanted.
And we have discussed the idea of, for example, the compulsory license model was initially like existing pretty much in contention with this one. We were discussing it both at once, and I think one of the ways that we'd initially thought might be done would be by licensing a particular peer-to-peer client. So you take some kind of, you pay for the software, to use the software, and that software gives you access to this entire group of files, which sure are out there in other clients too, sure that's going to mesh with other peer-to-peer networks, but you're going to get the best access through this client. Of course, you have massive problems. The whole point of the system is to evade the problems of control that exist. Can we take some more?
This idea of not removing the element of control that copyright owner has is something that I think is attractive about that model.
Maybe we can shift to the discussion about how to turn it on there.
If we can take some more, just a couple more people here.
We're going to do it in order. This is distributed.
In digital systems, you can actually measure consumption, so why not? Why not have a general license and you have access to all the music, but you measure exactly who downloads?
Ah, we discussed that, yeah.
Just have to know the relative amount, okay? Yep. That will enable minority parties to have, but I think for the second one, if you want to really decouple the consumption, then I would think it's done in a universal bridge. Again, that's very important right now. But basically, take all the transfers that are already existing today, knowing that 40% of the money goes to the selection mechanism of the bureaucrats and the ministry, you could get every request you give me, what is it, €600 or something, if you do that, you have an answer to your problem, because it means that if you want to be an artist and you make bad music, you just do it because you have it from you. If you want to go with your sheep,
we think that's the liberation thing.
This is a very politicized system, you know, where the stream is by the mobilizers and all the money go to Shabok.
We did try and provide against that kind of mobilization by ensuring for total anonymity in the relation between who gives the money and who's getting the money, so you can't.
Information people want to go to a few places they know they cannot possibly
but
yeah,
but it's a matter, well, it's a matter of can we just go back for a moment? I mean, yes, maybe, you know, the fundamentalists would make you know, be able to organize themselves so as to be extracting from the system. But my answer to your answer to this, so what? I mean, why should we devise a system which is based, why do we devise a system for the distribution of funding for cultural production based upon an ideological preference? People from the far left would do the same thing. The people who are fighting for universal minimum wage will do the same thing. They do that. There will be, you know, I mean, there will be some test of, like, you know, people competing to get the allocations. I think that that's the logic of the current system which we have, of the commodity model, and of the claims of the music film. And, there's one of the reasons why we came up with this idea was, are you familiar with the Zipf curve? Which is the distribution. Zipf curve is something which has been found to function in a lot of cultural industries. And it's a way of describing the distribution of revenues against the number of participants. And basically, the Zipf curve looks something like this. About 2% or a tiny, tiny number of the producers pick up 80% or more of the total revenues. The next 6 or 7% take another 18 or 19% of the revenues. And the vast majority of the people are down here on the bottom, not receiving anything. And that's why so many people who are, that's why people who produce, so many musicians are working in restaurants. Same is true of people who are working in fine arts, or they have to have a job as a graphic designer. It's the same reason why people who are writing free software don't have to have a job as a system administrator or whatever during the day. And what we want to do is we want to create a situation where more people could earn a living by producing culture full time or for a certain part of the year. That's why we want to break, that's why we want to get rid of consumption. Because this figure also is based on the fact that there is an economy to popularity. And that is expressed through the public relations industry, the marketing industry, the vertical integration of the media business, whereby the same companies which control music labels also own part of the television stations which broadcast those works. They work in many cities, they also work on, they own the venues where bands can play or where films can be shown. So there's a whole system of preference formation which we think would be worthwhile breaking.
And let's be clear that the way in which you as a producer set yourself up to take money from the consumers, it could take a number of different forms. We're not saying that everyone has to simply say, just give me some money and I'll just make some music. What you might do is use like the Schneier street performer protocol and say, here's three songs I made, give me some money and I'll start to release songs. So I'll start to release songs as you give it, when the money gets above a certain threshold, I'll release some more songs. And then you do have a direct, just because everyone isn't working on that basis, you may well then give some money to them on the basis that you want to hear four more songs, creating exactly the kind of relation that you want without directly linking it to downloads or something like this. Because one of the points is that some of the stuff, if you linked it directly to downloads, I download lots of stuff I don't like. I download it just to listen to it once and I throw it away. You can do it on listens, but how are you going to track these things? It's kind of too onerous and it's also too invasive. So, sorry, did you get yours as well? Let's go. We are into questions now, I think, so officially. So you were next, I think.
And then there's another one over here.
Then, if it fits into the discussion, let's have it. I mean, it sounds. How long will it take?
5 minutes.
Oh, then is that all right with everyone else? Okay, maybe we'll do it later on then.
Is that okay?
Is that all right?
We can do it in the session.
Okay.
Another question and then Chris after that.
A very important point about it is actually the licensing system itself. Is it about being able to download MP3s? Or is it about improving the culture, for example, the musical culture? In that case, we don't necessarily need access to the regularly mixed and compressed music, but we need access to the notation, we need access to the non-mixed
when we first came up with this model. One of the people who was at the table came up with it with us was Richie Horton. I don't know if you know him, he's Plastic Man, one of the people who was involved in the Detroit techno, I mean, production of Detroit techno, and therefore one of the founders of techno as we sort of know it. And he was, I mean, immediately we got into discussing the fact that this would totally allow people to release all their files, both as mixed music for people who want it like that, and as tracked, you know, 8-track and 24-track recordings with all completely intact, so that you could remix things from the word go. Because I think one of the things that he recognised and made it possible to discuss this openly was the fact that all music is based on, for example, sampling. Most, in fact, pretty much all digital musicians use each other's music as a way of life. It's a fundamental of the way people. And I mean, this has become really obvious with like the recent trend for bootlegs. You know, the people just sort of brutally mixing two tracks together and kind of releasing them in a bit of sort of low key way. But it's obvious that most musicians have this intimate relation with each other's music, and currently they have to kind of deny it. They can't afford to license. They can't afford to go around and track everyone down and license the samples they use. What most people do now on the dance music scene is release records without licensing any of the samples they use. And their model is, if it gets famous enough that you get sued and you have to pay the money, then you probably do all right anyway, because the next record you release, you can afford to pay the license fees. So they kind of have to lie. They all know that they're doing it. Everybody knows that. And what this would allow is complete openness. And so one of the key things we should just quickly mention as a result of that, the fact that the files are open, you can remix them, you can take chunks out of them, you can use themes out of them, you can do anything you want with the file. Attribution becomes extremely important. And we'd imagined, initially when we discussed this, we left attribution out. We didn't discuss it at all. And what we got was infuriated writers and artists saying, but I made this. And we got into these kind of discussions about what's the nature of production and sociality, and doesn't everyone really make everything anyway? Do you really consider yourself to be the creator
from
nothing? And the individual, isn't it all social? Don't you really have to recognise? And you realise that people are chomping at the bit. They don't want to lose their right to attribution. And when you think about it, in academia, which is a sort of, it's a similar sort of technically non-commodity model for distribution of information, attribution becomes key. And the right to be attributed as an author is hardwired into the system. From the word go, you're told that plagiarism is the worst crime you can commit, and you are out of the academy.
As it's also expressed in the GPL, right?
Yeah.
In terms of the list at the beginning, I mean, in the documentation of all of the people who've made a contribution to the project.
And so
I understood your question, though, to be slightly different, which was that you're interested in the actual documentation outside of the product. In terms of, you were talking about notation and things like that.
For example, if I want to learn how to play the guitar, I can listen. Well, there's drums, there's bass, there's keyboards, and somewhere there's a bit of guitar. So I have a hard time to find out what is actually played with the guitar.
Yeah.
I can, if I have the masters, I can cut it up.
Yeah, sure.
But then
Well, that's up to the artist. It's up to the artist.
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's something. You know, that's something which you could require. I mean, for example, you know, under the present patent system, right? In order to get a patent, you actually have to disclose how it works, and you need to provide a description. Now, I mean, actually, the requirement to provide proper descriptions so as to be able to make the invention function is something which patent lawyers and patent drafters are paid to get around, and so as to keep it obscure. But I think that we could, you could imagine, though, putting a requirement like that in under the scheme to require disclosure in terms of notation. It's a good point.
It's actually a very good point. You have to deliver the source.
Yeah.
And for music, the master tape or the notation is the source. Mm-hmm.
Can I just rattle on a bit about attribution? A bit more? Just
can we just take...
Okay, so just quickly about attribution before we take this question. So we'd imagine something, well, eventually when we discuss this question of being the right to be attributed as the creator of a thing, whether we agree or not, that's... Oh, just, yeah, okay, go ahead.
Because this way they have a guarantee of payment.
I mean,
if they're if they pay, I mean, if you pay out the concerts.
Well, you can. One of the points to make is that you. This doesn't mean that you couldn't. I mean, firstly, it doesn't mean that those artists who want to continue working with the traditional structures can do that. They can go ahead and try their luck. The second thing is that it doesn't prevent you as an artist in any way from going to a label or a label coming to you and saying, these are our resources. We have these promotional resources, we have these marketing resources, we have access to these venues, we have access to these agents, we can book you here, so on and so forth. You could still make a deal with them. They might say, we'll put £2 million into you this year, we'll promote your music, float it out, do what you normally do, float it out over the network and get people to listen to it. And they take a percentage of the money that comes to you from the people that year. There's nothing to prevent them from doing that within the structure. So you can avail yourself of the traditional marketing routes if you want, or you can bootstrap it and just put a web page up yourself and say, I don't want to deal with these vampire motherfuckers. I want to make the music myself, put a web page up and you know. Yeah, if you want to. Whatever you want, whatever you think is going to be the most effective route for you. So we should probably go straight on to the questions now.
Right. I agree with the critique of the existing system, and I think that's very good. That's the best thing I've heard about that. I agree with the end goal, wanting to see more copylefted art. I think that's great. Fully agree with that. I just do not understand at all, to be honest, the bit in the middle, how the money gets into the system. You've mentioned the taxation, you mentioned the donations. The taxation, you know, you're coming right up against, you know, kind of current, well, you need to go up against, you know, big multinationals. And
in what way against the...
Well, to get a country to decide that, okay, we're going to tax our citizens, you know, to produce art in this manner, you know, I don't,
what you're saying is you do understand it, but you don't think it's realistic.
Or feasible. Politically feasible.
I just don't get that bit. I mean, Yeah, you can say you're doing it with donations.
It's difficult, that's why we're getting...
yeah, you can say, you know, you're really... It's going to be a voluntary thing. If in terms of if you're wanting to do it, you know, through taxation or something...
But in many countries, you already have those taxes. I mean, in the whole of continental Europe, you already have those taxes. They're not technically taxes, but they're still anywhere. And people are paying this money already,
yeah. Whether it's on blank CDs or cassettes, whether it's through the money which funds arts councils, whether it's the money which goes for television licenses, all of these kind of things. You know, I mean, like, that's a very large amount of money. So even without thinking about even instituting a new tax, if we just change the way in which the existing public monies for culture was being used, then that would already be a lot of money to be able to give out.
I think the way we understood it was at this stage, we're at the kind of developing the model stage, turning up in situations like this, getting people to input things, tweaking it, changing it, and the next stage we go on to will be lobbying and making the public aware of this so that we could get the tax. So this was the initial thing, but then we decided... we've got a problem of sort of left liberals in the group and then leftists in the group, and so this creates huge arguments about whether the state should or shouldn't be involved in the thing. And this is why we moved maybe towards thinking of other ways in which you could get people to pay money into such a fund. And in no way are we saying this is practical and we can do it now. Really, why we do it, and it becomes far more relevant in a group of people who never thought about the idea that the things they make could be anything other than commodities, it becomes clear that it's very useful as a think model, just to get people to think about how they could exist without commodities in there.
It's also very useful as an interruption of what is otherwise the discussion around copyright law, right? Which is about how it's theft, about how anti-circumvention devices are burglars' tools, you know, about pirates, about how people need to be locked up, about how HROs should be taught in school to respect intellectual property laws. So in this sort of sense, I mean, even if the proposal has lots of problematic aspects, it functions, if you like, as a political device to change the nature of the discussion and to pose also the question about what kind of outcomes do we want. We have this paradigm change in terms of the technology, which allows us to rethink about what is a desirable result. So it says, like, instead of the natural result being that you two make hundreds of millions of dollars every year, and meanwhile everybody else, you know what I mean, plays music in garages and, you know what I mean, works a day job. Well, it says, like, is that the way that things want to be? It doesn't have to be, you know. So, I mean, so it's useful from that way. It also attacks, you know, the laws in terms of criminalization, in terms of surveillance, you know, in terms of... you know, what's going on in terms of some of the hardware companies, the 4C companies, you know what I mean, who want to institute digital rights management technology into people's laptop and desktop computers. They basically want to take control of your computer out of your hands. So it's a way of providing a way to fuck with that conversation.
Can I ask another question? You're talking about the artists. Just the other day, I noticed on the Free Software Foundation website, where they talk about licenses for things other than software or documentation, and they mentioned the Design Science license, this is GPL compatible. There's also a French license called the Arts Something license, I can't remember exactly the term, and there's actually a criticism of that, in as much as they say this gives too much weight to the concept of the creator. Mm. And I was wondering if that's something you might... I read that and it didn't click with me what they were trying to get at.
Yeah, the reason we started discussing it was because of the disgust that excited in your kind of classic bourgeois subject, that I am the creator, and been trained to think about themselves in this way. I think sadly because of the connection to commodity capitalism. And so we, in a way you want to say, we're going to, at the very least, not actively antagonise the people you want to be involved in the system by telling them they have to give up their right to understand themselves as a desocialised, atomised individual. But they have that, at least that basic legacy right to understand themselves in that way. So, okay, you may be... And also, I thought that to me it would seem a positive thing if you imagined getting a copy of Moby's latest album, which relied on his access that his label had given him to the chess back catalogue or the domino back catalogue, all these fantastic blues recordings, and he's taken those things, ripped them mercilessly, looped them, put them into bar loops, looped them and run some rubbish over the top of it, and made millions and millions over it, off it. And I think it would be interesting if he was compelled to commit the deal, his company was compelled to commit due diligence and list out every sample that was used, and just say, so in our case we're saying you don't have to pay to use those samples, but you have to list them, you have to say where they came from. Now in that case you could open it and say, a kid might say, I really like this Moby thing, but actually when I looked at it I realised here's all these records I'd never heard of, and that provides an interesting link into people actually understanding the roots, understanding the multiple roots of any one given piece of music. And of course it's slightly trivial to say that it should all be like samples, because it's not just about what you sample. It could be themes, or it could be ideas, it could be, just small figures, musical figures, that in this case that you're using. But some form of complex attribution system, that allows you to follow the pathway from the creation of the thing into the multiple kind of vectors that have led into you making it, I think could actually be desirable.
I think whatever about the actual, the discussion about the specifics of the license, the important thing is not to allow that desire for control to dictate either the course of the technological development, that is, say, to require the hardwiring of the possibility to control attribution into the actual machines, and it's important not to allow that insistence also to create situations where you have laws which will, criminal laws under which people can be prosecuted. I mean, that's, I think that, that's the crux of the matter, what I mean? All the other discussions about attribution and about moral rights we can have, but the important thing is not to threaten control and criminalisation over the technology and its use.
Yeah, I think customary code is the way to go about it. As with the commons, as with the original feudal commons, you have a set of shared resources regulated by a highly, highly complex, structured set of customary codes. They're not embedded in any written law, but nonetheless completely coded the way that the rights you had over a particular piece of land, when you got to use it, what you got to do with it, whose it was perceived as being able to live there or be there or work with it, none of which were written down in any way, and none of which were certainly not coded into law, and certainly not the subject of legal discipline, and yet, worked perfectly well as a way of regulating. And the same with academia. I mean, I know the things are written down about plagiarism, but the thing works, it's supported through socialisation, through the sort of the inherent idea which, that you actually think plagiarism is a crime, within that structure.
You said this model can be expanded to an industrial area. Do you have in your mind, the later part of the dream or whatever it is, a kind of society which constitutes this kind of model in different industries?
A society based on self-management.
Legacy issues. That's why we discussed this threshold problem, because I think we hoped for a flattening of the zip curve. We hoped that more people would, the money would naturally make its way into more local music, and people would become less. The star system would gradually be degraded through this. Through the implementation of this model. But in the meantime, you have to recognise that right now kids are going to give their money to Britney Spears. there's going to be nothing you can do about it until this process of education. You know,
but also
kind of the transitional period.
Yeah, transitional period.
But also, I mean, the other thing is that why should the abolition of money take place? I'm all for the abolition of money. Okay, but what I object to, and I think it's been a major problem in terms of the political discussion over, for example, file sharing applications, right, is that it's almost as if people want to abolish money only in the cultural sphere, so that somehow it is legitimate to get paid for producing other types of commodities, whether it's motor cars or seeds or pharmaceuticals, but it's not legitimate to earn a living producing culture. Now, I think that you either have money or you don't have money. You know, and if we're going to abolish money in the area of cultural production, then abolish it in society as a whole and deal with the consequences, the social consequences of that. But I don't think that, you know, Jamie mentioned it earlier on, you know, the threat of returning to an aristocratic model, a feudal model of cultural production, whereby you can only produce and you can only get distribution if you have a lot of resources existing, if you've inherited money, if, you know, you don't need to work, so you've got time to dedicate your life, you know, or because of the fact that you're the benefit of a patron, a system of patronage. And one of the good things about our system, I think, is the fact that it turns us all into micro-patrons. But it means that each of our contributions is so small in terms of the total amount of money collected that it doesn't allow us to dictate the nature, the quality of the cultural output.
I didn't mention that we kind of considered this, and the money that was earmarked for infrastructure was partly earmarked for education, so educating people in how to use such a system responsibly, for want of a better word, and actually another thing I didn't mention was that even people who didn't pay tax or money into the system, such as children, would obviously have voting rights in terms of who they were going to give them. You know, obviously it's important that children and old people who are not paying or people who don't pay for various reasons should have the right to be able to apportion the funds. And so those people, especially in the case of children, need to be, you know, they're both being educated through the use of the system. I don't have to give my money to Britney Spears. I can give it to my friends who make music. I can give it to the band that's down the road. Well, then when they get the idea of this, things are going to change. I just think things are going to change over time. But education and talking about how the way that you act, you know, in this case, could make a big difference to the kind of music you're going to hear around you, would be a big part of it, I think.
I'd like to do this test. We have two more questions here. Yeah. After we finish the round of questions,
sure.
Then you're going to end your speech.
Sure.
And we're going to have a discussion because now you've just pulled out of what people are trying to say, right? So that would be my suggestion. You agree?
In what sense?
We're quite happy.
We're quite happy just being pulled out of this speech because I thought.
No.
We can go where people want to go. It's more interesting. It's more interesting for us.
I think everyone's got the idea.
Is that
it,
right?
It seems like so.
There seems to be a lot of questions.
So
it's good to hear the questions.
Yeah.
So and then Graham. Then. Yeah. You mean like the current system?
What?
You mean in the same way that the current system
yes.
encourages people
yes.
through the...
Because
Yeah.
And in a performance system, which would be more capable, then we can have more kind of things. So I think we should clarify between both possible systems.
The difference between those two systems only that the amount of money that is available on private sector. I got it that way, that in the tax way, you have some tax, probably even not related to the amount of things we give you.
Yeah. And the arguments for that are clear. You know, people would argue, well, I'm deaf, or I don't take part in art, visual art, or I don't download software. And you say no, but you pay the money because across the board it ramifies for everyone's sociality and everyone benefits from this, so you pay. It's the same whether you pay or don't pay.
The difference would be that in the donation system, the consumer decide how he makes the distribution.
You always decide how you make the distribution.
You mean that it's always the same amount?
Yes.
Yeah. No, you make that decision. That's your decision. There's nobody in the bureaucracy making a decision about where your money goes. Sorry?
Yes, in the tax system. All the state
exactly.
is doing is all the state is doing is providing a disciplinary apparatus that
just
allows
just a distribution mechanism.
No, yes,
that's right.
Yeah, no.
Yes,
you got it. Yes. Yes. Oh, really?
This is really... Why?
Because you don't believe in your right to have an opinion.
Do you not think that you're competent to make the decision?
He thinks he's an idiot. I think you're...
No. Why? Why? Because you can now get Madonna's music and you don't have to pay for it. So why would she get the same amount of money under our system that she gets under the present system? I think Madonna could only get less money under our system.
Yeah. Well, it would be less, but it would be quite a lot, because I think that the whole fan system, the whole life around somebody, is not abolished by this.
But that's not something that... I mean, that's not something that you can change through any clever system. That's a function, as we said, of the political economy of glamour. It's a function of the public relations industry and marketing. And what can you do? I mean, can you create a law to force people not to give money to Madonna? This is the same thing as what Michael brought up. You know what I mean? Can you stop people from giving the money to a fundamentalist rock band or a Nazi rock band?
How do you do that?
We go back to our zip code. How much surveillance does that require?
Yeah, that is.
What type of surveillance? What type of control of the level of your computer or whatever means you're using to consume your culture or to listen to your music or to watch a film? What kind of surveillance does that require to be put
into? It's going
to
be hardware level. And I'm downloading lots of stuff that I then listen to, that I then burn onto a CD and listen to in a completely unrelated device 85 times. You know, and you're going to track that by putting a chip in every single device I own. Then we're getting to the point of being as bad as they are.
Royalty system already, at least in Germany, with all these fees for the audio tapes, CDs, and so on.
and that money goes to the industry, to the record industry. It doesn't go to the artists. Here it doesn't. Well, I mean, in terms of...
It doesn't. Yeah, but does it really? Is a really effective system for delivering it to the composers? Because almost all... You mean you've got some? You had some? Yeah.
And it works really well.
Well, that's good. You should probably study how they do it.
Oh, can I think it was... and then you...
A related thing to the last one, which is that you're making the assumption that kind of circuit is created by publicity, by the general capitalist apparatus promoting big companies' products.
Commodity culture, yeah. Do you have that? Well, do you have that within Linux? I mean, in terms of the different distributions.
That's also.
Is there one distribution? I mean, that is taking 80 or 90% of the Linux market.
Is there one?
Is there one? So, whether it's Debian or SUSE or Red Hat.
Blogs. If you look at like the way that, because it strikes me that the software example, you're absolutely right, but there's like a development time that means that you don't see in blogging, like a blog entry. Someone blogs a good entry, and the daily top 40, like the blog dex, hits to that blog and say, and then it then has an emergent effect because people go to the blog dex and see, okay, this is the top story of the day, and they all go to, and they hit the site more, and so the site gets hit more, and it gets into a loop, which is probably similar to the Linux loop, the loop between popularity and promotion and use. But whereas in Linux, I guess development time means there are only a certain amount of choices. The next day in the blog world, there's another entry to look at, and so you have effectively flattened. You haven't got everyone going CNN, BBC, and so on. You've got people saying, today I want to see that story. Today that's in the top 10. Tomorrow this is in the top 10. So you have a similar winner-takes-all, but the time that the winner can take it for is reduced significantly, and so in effect you still have a flattening of the zip curve. So I think you take it on a case-by-case example, and you can see that music exists somewhere in between those two points, right?
Okay, thank you. This is a good answer. Sweden, not a very good question.
Sure. Maybe because musicians only have session. That's all we get to do is session. You know, if I can play the guitar well enough, I can go and get roughly £100 a day, cash in hand, just about once every 3 months to go and play guitar on some bastard's horrible album. And then, but you know, I'm not like a programmer. I can go and work with Citibank. Not that I'm suggesting everyone should, but I know for a fact that of my programmer friends, the vast majority of them cycle in and out of quite well-paid security positions. And then they come out and work.
It's a very different mode of production, though, as well. You know, I mean, in terms of like my brother used to work with some of you may know Dragon. It was developed by a company called Res Rocket Surfer, which allowed people to play online together and to compose together. It went down the tubes years ago, but it's much more. They were tools that were available, and the hardware that was available that was necessary was accessible by a much, much smaller number of people. Do you know what I mean? So concretely, the cheap cost, you know what I mean, of a commodity PC, you know, and the possibilities that that offers in terms of cooperative productivity, you know, on an international basis, without any of the problems of, like, the bandwidth required, for example, to engage in an online jamming session simultaneously. It's just, I think there are different set of circumstances, but I wouldn't pretend to make any claims about what really deeper reasons there might be as to those differences between the software, free software community and the noisy community.
Just a guess, just a practical guess why musicians are constantly complaining, because they are starving in garrets most of the time.
Might be a once, might be a once that they get into the hospital already ended up as full time musicians, whereas most free software programmers have another job to get
saying, sorry?
I'm glad to say that it makes more sense for me to for musicians to say you get paid for the copying of the music. You should get paid for making the music live music on stage.
But this doesn't... are you asking about the question of the
No, it's suggesting an explanation.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right, so there's a difference in terms of the monetizability
yeah.
of the actual activity. You had a question, didn't you?
Yeah.
No?
But one point more for your
why?
I think we backed off from the idea of having a maximum cap.
Well, no, what we decided in favour of... Well, what we thought might be more interesting would just be to have full disclosure. To have disclosure of the information about how much somebody had received in allocations at any given moment and allow people to make that determination themselves so they can say, that person has 50 million, that's more than enough. I'm going to give it to the 16-year-olds who live next door. Well, it's up to you. I mean, you can make it as you can make as small or as large a donation as you want.
Just think about if you can make a download, it would like one or somebody. Do not walk to the bank, fill out a sheet to transfer some money to somebody and say, I'm not available. But if you can do a micropayment.
Yeah, no, it should be that simple. Yeah, but it would be very simple because the money's already been, say in the tax structure, the money's already in the pool in an escrow account. So it's all held there. What you have is a set of credits that you can give out, and it's literally as easy as just saying.
And the tax will prevent free riding.
It's just a click on it.
Yeah. Free riding. so that some people would just not contribute anything to the system at all, but at the same time be able to enjoy its benefits. Have a very leisurely life. I want your life. But what's the problem? By making it easy for people to actually carry out the allocation. I mean, I think there's a lot of technical issues involved there in terms of...
I'm sure they can build hard systems for that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Undoubtedly, there will be third-party structures for that. But, you know, you'd be free to develop that kind of thing. Obviously, there's going to be people with those concerns. And as you go through the issues that you're bringing up about how do I use such a system responsibly, how do I really make it reflect? If that's what you want, you know, if you want it to reflect the way you listen to music this year, because maybe you want it to reflect how you think about music next year, maybe you don't, you're not interested in what you heard this year. You want, but if you want it to reflect the system, you could go with some people who've probably written some software, right? You know, to say, this is what you listen to, this is the kind of thing you listen to most, so give you money here.
Or you might decide that there was a specific gap which wasn't being filled. One of the areas which kind of inspired me in this regard was thinking about the way in which, for example, investigative journalism needs to be financed. You know, it's not based upon the commodity version of news, right? Sometimes it requires people to actually work for months, you know, in terms of research or going to actually the site where something happened to interview people firsthand. And we know that there are very, very few places, you know, in terms of the newspaper and magazine world, who are willing to finance that type of activity, you know. So, I mean, you know, I would, you know, that, you know, you could imagine that there would be people out there who think that that type of information is important for society to have, and who would thus say, well, out of my 100 euros every year, I'm going to give 50 of that to funding 5 investigative journalists.
Regardless, I never read anything this year, and I just think it's important. You could decide for a total disconnect between what you did this year and what you want next year. You could do it on whatever basis you want. And it's kind of up to you to make those decisions. And that, I think that's the point about the conversation we're having.
And you'll get shortfalls. In different years, you'll get shortfalls. You know what I mean? Some years won't be enough of, you know what I mean? People will notice the fact that they're not getting, if they, you know, for example, you can imagine, say, a Hollywood blockbuster, right? Big movies. I don't like them very much. I like stuff which is more commitment to narrative and to, you know, exploring drama and things like that. But a lot of people like Hollywood.
I like,
right? So I mean, if under this system the studios or the organizations which are in position to produce these like $50 million, $100 million blockbusters, heavy special effects, Star Wars 88, you know what I mean? It's then the following year people would realize that they would factor that in to their decisions about their allocations.
Yeah, so that's already true though. I mean, if you take musicians, that's what they do at the moment. You know, you just work where you can, you get your money where you can, and try and put some recordings together, demos usually, and you go on bended knees to the labels and say, "Please fuck us." That's what you do already, and it's not in that sense. There's always going to be a moment of entry into the market, and what we're saying here is, you know, at the very least, we're saying we'll fund the infrastructure that'll allow you to go and, you know, turn up and get some decent resources. You know, it's not. You can't change the fact that you're going to have to promote yourself in some way. You're going to have to make something. You know, I mean, it could be an organisation that sets itself up at this end that says, all we do is fund kids who want to make music. You know, what we do is fund those, and I might give money to them because I quite like that idea. You know, I don't want people to have to scratch around.
But also, in any given year, there are films made which you never get to see because of the way in which the cinema theatre system is structured, right, in terms of distribution, whereby, you know, you only get... The theatre only gets to show The Matrix if they agree to show, you know,
Harry Potter,
or, you know, The Lord of the Rings, or whatever. You know what I mean? This is a monopolistic structure which is nurtured, which is cultivated by the copyright monopoly, by the copyright regime. So, that, I mean, there's more films made every year than you could ever possibly, you know, the opportunity to see. But you don't get to see them because of the fact that the commercial venues are controlled by the major film studios through their distribution agreements or through direct ownership. So, I mean, it's difficult even, you know what I mean, to, I mean... Yeah.
I like The Matrix. I like Lord of the Rings, but anyway. Do we have...
We have documentation. Yeah.
Yeah.
We have some documentation, but...
It's going into the National Academy of Sciences thing, isn't it?
Well, we'll see.
Apparently.
No, I didn't know that to see...
Well, you can get
to see it. All the material has it will be made available through the urban
effect. Right, yeah. That's great, yeah.
No, it's ours. It's ours. What we're trying to do is actually something like a physical request for comments. You know, I mean, if you're familiar with that from the protocol world of, you know, internet protocols, you know, I mean, the idea is actually to get input. You know what I mean? For example, the suggestion that you made about documentation in terms of musical notation is something which I hadn't thought about at all.
Yeah.
And sorry?
Internationalisation. Tax system operates in one country. The tax on copyright global. Surely this has to be global.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Because it would take would be for one country to institute it to throw the system into real crisis, actually.
Well, we have about 12 minutes left.
Okay, so can everyone
who still has questions? And who hasn't asked a question yet? You haven't asked a question yet.
And then, do you want to present his model, I think?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it could be any kind of cultural production.
Kind of group that's established some kind of gallery and exhibition.
Yeah, it could be any kind of cultural production.
But the thing is, such a system exists. Actually, there's a website. It was launched in February here in Berlin. It was also a two-guy project. We don't want to do with that. And I think if you still have time, you can use them.
Oh, great.
Oh, can you just tell us a little bit more about what they did?
It's a community site. You put some money in, got some governmental minimum fees, some crime, and each 2 or 3 months they give away the money to the most sort of projects which get the most votes.
Right.
And whatever has to be low enough to make
it's a voting system.
Well, if you could give us some contact information, that'd be great. But I just want to tell you that there has been for some time in existence in the United States and Canada an organization called Fairtunes, who collect voluntary donations by file sharing users, and who then send musicians checks. in the post, and they've collected $8,000 or $9,000, something like that. And it's small; it's very small. But like, I mean, you know, there's quite a number of similar examples. I hadn't heard of anybody doing it in terms of the.
In terms of the
arts world.
Just the name again, because he didn't get it and I didn't get it either. The name of that company.
Because I forgot.
Okay.
Right.
Okay, and hold on a second, I just got to switch forward and make some noise.
Right. Yeah. Right. That's great. Just give us a second. We never got to talk about this.
Yeah, that's what I realized before. That's the reason.
But it's all right. We wanted to do it that way.
Yeah,
we'd rather talk ourselves stupid.
Him first, and then you. Come on up.
The main idea is deciding about allocation to producers by individual voting of consumers.
Mm-hmm.
I still wonder to what kind of content to make this work. I mean, music. Okay, I think that's the case. But what about the other things you mentioned? Investigative journalism, news channels, this kind of thing. For example,
sure.
Pharmaceuticals.
In terms of like basic scientific research, like.
Over the last few conversations I've been having at some political meetings about the need for a different set of reasons, the need for a way to form communities, make those communities accountable to each other, share information and resources between them. I've begun to think and have conversations that what we really need is a system that exists at a layer lower than this one. It doesn't say anything about what you have to do. It's not voting. There's no voting in the system.
Well, no, but there is self-management, though. I mean, there is self-organisation.
Yes, but there's not a vote. There's no voting structure here, is there? There's no we vote for this person and then they get the money. You give the money to, you give it to them. You give the resource to them. That's the relation. It's not about 1,000 people saying we will decide when we give this money. You know, it doesn't work like that.
No.
And so what I was thinking is, yes, I mean, why not make a structure that could be practically used by anyone? They're not. But the big difference between a voting system, a classical democratic voting system, and that is that if you don't, if your vote isn't successful in voting democracies, your voice is essentially lost. It's essentially useless in this.
But he's talking about voting, though, in terms of the allocation, not talking about as a decision.
Yeah, he's calling
not talking about a binary decision-making method. A yes, no.
Yeah, he's trying to get me to call it votes, and I'm saying that classical voting has a set of disadvantages that this doesn't have. That's why I will refuse to use the term. I think that's all right.
Making decisions about power and society, this kind of thing, if you really think about a generalized system of the sort, not just for journalism,
for everything, I think.
For research, other kinds of research.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, you know, what our proposition is contingent upon is people actually, in terms of if it's to be successful, is for people actually to take the responsibility to inform themselves enough to be able to finance the type of culture that they need. And, you know, on that level, it attempts to strengthen and to encourage self-government or direct democratic control over resources in a way which has obvious applications to other areas, you know. It would be very interesting, for example, in the United States, just as, you know, one instance. If people were, you know, specifically shown how much money is spent on, if people had the choice about how much money was to be spent on military spending every year, or whether they decide that they prefer that money, in fact, to go into providing a social security system or a medical system, or to pay, you know what I mean, for, you know, development in countries, you know, in the Middle East. You know, I mean, so I mean, I think that it's true that, I mean, like, the type of kind of cultural attitude that we're trying to cultivate is one which has obvious applications to other areas.
Across the field. Should we take the last questions? And then, like, we've got, how long have we got? Ten
I don't think that we have any.
Oh, we've got seven minutes. So one more question and then 5 minutes. Yeah, but remember that we didn't design the system to erase the star of the cult of charisma or the cult. We didn't believe that wasn't one of the things we set out to find a way of doing. What we set out to do was to discover a non-commodity way people could live through making music. And we can't, I mean, this is quite fairly, I think, we respond, we can't immediately change the entire field of social relations. And that kind of valorization of the individual, I believe, is a legacy for low result. Particular set of practical relations that will change, undoubtedly will change over time. In what direction will change is up to history. But we're not trying to claim that we can change that overnight by the instantiation of a particular technological system fix. I don't think that would be absolute hubris to just even attempt to theorize how we might do that. I think that's it. We've run out of time. We just pulled it out of the air. No, we just pulled it out.
Just might be somebody isn't interested in music at all, not as an individual, but
yeah,
might want to, well, 15 million is enough, it doesn't be 100 million.
Yeah.
Someone that's more interested in the investigation.
Yeah, there's always going to be arguments about how much tax you should pay.
Well, like, I mean, if you have a series of activities and people can make the decision themselves as to whether the money is to go into music or to investigative journalism or to film, then people can make that decision themselves.
All right. So thanks, and we'll listen to the other.
And we'll be here as well for the rest of the weekend if anybody wants to discuss this further or if there are bits that weren't understood.